The Eagle's Shadow by James Branch Cabell.
29. She sat silent in one corner of the darkened room. It was the bedroom that Frederick R. Woods formerly occupied, on the ground floor of Selwood, opening into the living hall, to which they had carried Billy. Jewkesbury had done what he could. In the bed lay Billy Woods, swathed in hot blankets, with bottles of hot water set to his feet. Jewkesbury had washed his face clean of that awful red, and had wrapped bandages of cracked ice about his head, and propped it high with pillows. It was little short of marvelous to see the pursy old hypocrite going cat-footed about the room on his stealthy ministrations, replenishing the bandages, forcing spirits of ammonia between Billy's teeth, fighting deftly and confidently with death. Billy still breathed. The colonel came and went uneasily. The clock on the mantel ticked. Margaret brooded in a silence that was only accentuated by that horrible, wheezing, gurgling, tremulous breathing in the bed yonder. Would the doctor never come? She was curiously conscious of her absolute lack of emotion, but always the interminable thin whispering in the back of her head went on and on. Oh, if he had only died 4 years ago. Oh, if he had only died the dear, clean-minded, honest boy I used to know. When that noise stops, he will be dead. And then perhaps I shall be able to cry. Oh, if he had only died 4 years ago. And then, da capo. On and on ran the interminable thin whispering as Margaret waited for death to come to Billy. Billy looked so old now under his many bandages. Surely he must be very, very near death. Suddenly, as Jewkesbury wrapped new bandages about his forehead, Billy opened his eyes and, without further movement, smiled placidly up at him. "Hello, Jewkesbury," said Billy Woods. "Where's my armor?" Jewkesbury, too, smiled. "The man is bringing it downstairs now," he answered quietly. "Because," Billy went on fretfully, "I don't propose to miss the Trojan War. The princes Orgulus with high blood chaffed, you know, are all going to be there, and I don't propose to miss it." Behind his fat back, Petheridge Jewkesbury waved a cautioning hand at Margaret, who had risen from her chair. "But it is very absurd," Billy murmured in the mere ghost of a voice, "because men don't propose by mistake, except in farces. Somebody told me that, but I can't remember who, because I am a misogynist. That is a Greek word, and I would explain it to Peggy if she would only give me a chance, but she can't, because she has those 1,750,000 children to look after. There must be some way to explain to her, though, because where there's a will, there is always a way, and there were 3 wills. Uncle Fred should not have left so many wills. Who would have thought the old man had so much ink in him? But I will be a very great painter unto Uncle Fred, and make her sorry for the way she had treated me, and then Kathleen will understand I was talking about Peggy." His voice died away, and Margaret sat with wide eyes listening for it again. Would the doctor never come? Billy was smiling and picking at the sheets. "But Peggy is so rich," the faint voice presently complained. "So beastly rich. There is gold in her hair, and if you will look very closely, you will see that her lashes were pure gold until she dipped them in the ink pot. Besides, she expects me to sit up and beg for lumps of sugar, and I never take sugar in my coffee, and Peggy doesn't drink coffee at all, so I think it is very unfair, especially as Teddy Anstruther drinks like a fish, and she is going to marry him. Peggy, why won't you marry me? You know I've always loved you, Peggy, and now I can tell you so because Uncle Fred has left me all his money. You think a great deal about money, Peggy. You said it was the greatest thing in the world, and it must be because it is the only thing, Peggy, that has been strong enough to keep us apart. Apart is never greater than the whole, Peggy, but I will explain about that when you open that desk. There are sharks in it, aren't there, Peggy? Aren't there?" His voice had risen to a querulous tone. Gently, the fat old man restrained him. "Yes," said Petheridge Jewkesbury. "Dear me, yes. Why, dear me, of course." But his warning hand held Margaret back. Margaret, who stood with big tears trickling down her cheeks. "Dearer than life itself," Billy assented wearily. "But before God, loving you as I do, I wouldn't marry you now for all the wealth in the world. I forget why, but all the world is a stage, you know. And they don't use stages now, but only railroads. Is that why you rail at me so, Peggy?" "That is a joke. You ought to laugh at my jokes, because I love you. But I can't ever, ever tell you because you are rich. A rich man cannot pass through a needle's eye. Oh, Peggy, Peggy, I love your eyes. But they're so big, Peggy. So Billy Woods lay still and babbled ceaselessly. But through all his irrelevant talk, as you may see a tributary stream pulse unsullied in a muddied river, ran the thought of Peggy. Of Peggy and of her cruelty, and of her beauty, and of the money that stood between them. And Margaret, who could never have believed him in his senses, listened and knew that in his delirium, the rudder of his thoughts snapped, he could not but speak truth. As she crouched in the corner of the room, her face buried in an armchair, her gold hair half loosened, her shoulders monotonously heaving, she wept gently, inaudibly, almost happily. Almost happily, Billy was dying, but she knew now past any doubting that he loved her. The dear, clean-minded, honest boy had come back to her, and she could love him now without shame, and there was only herself to be loathed. Then the door opened. Then, with Colonel Hugonin, came Martin Giel, a wisp of a man like a November leaf, and regarded them from under his shaggy white hair with alert eyes. "Hey, what's this?" said Dr. Giel. Ah, yes, he meditated slowly. "Most irregular. You must let us have the room, Miss Hugonin." In the hall she waited. Hope! Of course there was no hope, the thin little whisper told her. By and by, though, after centuries of waiting, the three men came into the hall. "Miss Hugonin," said Dr. Giel, with a strange kindness in his voice, "I don't think we shall need you again. I am happy to tell you, though, that the patient is doing nicely, very nicely indeed." Margaret clutched his arm. You mean? "I mean," said Dr. Giel, "that there is no fracture. A slight concussion of the brain, madam, and, so far as I can see, no signs of inflammation. Barring accidents, I think we'll have that young man out of bed in a week. Thanks," he added, "to Mr. Jukesbury here, whose prompt action was, under heaven, undoubtedly the means of staving off meningitis and probably, indeed more than probably, the means of saving Mr. Woods's life. It was splendid, sir, splendid. No, doctor, why, God bless my soul!" For Miss Hugonin had thrown her arms about Petheridge Jukesbury's neck and had kissed him vigorously. "You beautiful child," said Miss Hugonin.
Jukesbury, said the colonel mysteriously. "There's a little cognac in the cellar that,
The colonel jerked his thumb across the hallway with the air of a conspirator.
"Eh?" said the colonel. "Why, yes," said Mr. Jukesbury. "Why, yes, I think I might."
They went across the hall together. The colonel's hand rested fraternally on Petheridge Jukesbury's shoulder.